Hello again. You might be pleased to hear I'm not planning to do a talk or sermon in this session. So rest assured, you can relax now. Rather, in this session, I thought it would be really interesting. I hope it's really interesting. Well, I guess we'll find out over the next hour. I thought it'd be good for us to kind of conceptually take a step backwards from a sermon and imagine yourself kind of in the office or study or cafe, wherever it is you do your work. And actually do some of the kind of pre-work together. Put our heads together and grapple with some ideas. So the work you would normally do before then drafting your sermon, let's actually do some of that kind of pre-work together around some of the issues that Leviticus raises. Because I think that might be useful for us to kind of walk through that together. Lots of issues here are tricky. We can try and grapple with one of those. That's what I want us to do. So in some ways, it's a bit like Lego. We'll have some blocks at the end. And you could construct those Lego blocks into different things. You could probably construct a sermon on Leviticus 16, maybe Leviticus 4. You could do a topical sermon on the idea of sacrifice and what that might mean. You might even need enough blocks to do a sermon on Hebrews 9 and 10. So kind of blocks that you could construct in different ways. Let's work together to get some blocks, is what I want to do. Tim Keller, and you've probably read this in Tim Keller's stuff, he talks about the idea of defeater beliefs. So, definition in the handout here, just a defeater belief is belief A, that if true means belief B cannot be true. And so Keller works that out in relation to non-believers' appraisal of Christianity. So, kind of the questions that our non-Christian friends or contacts will raise that, in their mind, defeats the whole idea of Christianity. How can just one religion be true? For them, that's it. We're done. We don't need to talk any further. If you preach Leviticus, you'll come across a whole suite of defeater beliefs that people have. And so I did a session for an Anglican church in Sydney a few weeks ago. They're starting a series on Leviticus. They said, "Oh, can you come along and talk about Bible study leaders and all that?" So about 150 people in the room. So I talked through Leviticus, talked through different things about the book. And then the kind of Q&A time at the end. And inevitably this question comes up, and it came up. Somebody said, "But didn't Paul say the law was a burden, just like a schoolmaster until the time of Christ, and then it's done away with, and it's just kind of boom, drop mic. There you go, we don't need all this Leviticus stuff." That's the defeater beliefs. This is true, well then we don't need that. That can't be true. So I want us to think about defeater beliefs in relation to Leviticus. So here's another potential defeater belief. In relation to kind of the broader issues of sacrifice, we've been thinking about atonement, that sort of thing. So Hebrews 10:4 says, "It is impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins." How does that work with Leviticus? Interesting question. Let's do some work on that together. So you certainly don't have to look far to find examples of people using that as a defeater belief. Kind of just a mic drop, there you go. Don't need to think about Leviticus. So I want to pick on F.F. Bruce in relation to this. I should say I've got immense respect for F.F. Bruce. His stuff is brilliant. But I pick F.F. Bruce partly because he's dead. And so he's kind
Can't defend
of not
himself.
quite back. He can't quite back. Not so much for that. But you know, I don't mind trampling on toes, but sometimes it's better to trample on toes of somebody who is currently offended. But anyway, this is what F.F. Bruce says in his Hebrews commentary. So the quote again is in your handout for you. He says, "Spiritual imperfection was inevitable as long as people's ideas of God and forgiveness were bound up with a sacrificial cultus like that of early Israel. Such spiritual value as the sacrificial ritual might have lay in it being a material foreshadowing or object lesson of a moral and spiritual reality. Moral defilement cannot be removed by material means." But there you go, F.F. Bruce is what he says. Now, ignore for the moment, I think that Leviticus conveys God's ideas about God and forgiveness, not just people's ideas. And surely Jesus' blood is a material means of removing the problems. So park those two issues aside. But Bruce kind of takes Hebrews 10:4 as being this indicative statement about the ineffectiveness of Israel's cult. And he appeals to Psalm 51 in support. So again, this would be familiar for you, Psalm 51:18. "For you will not delight in sacrifice, or I would give it. You would not be pleased with a burnt offering." And so Bruce says, look at that. It was already recognized centuries before Jesus that the Old Testament called really achieved nothing. All Hebrews 10:4 is doing is summarizing a biblical truism. And then he moves on. I think Bruce's comments kind of encapsulate various evangelical conclusions regarding the cult in Leviticus. And so again, I've itemized some of these in your handout for you. Number one, the cult, material cult, served only to symbolize future spiritual realities. It's just symbolic in some sense, whatever that means. Number two, the Old Testament cult was useful only as it foreshadowed or typologically anticipated Christ. That's its value. Cultic activities functioned solely as pedagogical aids for Israel, kind of teaching aids, like an illustration, teaching them something. That's really all it's there for. The Old Testament cult was incapable of dealing with sin. And some people would add in impurity in that as well, but certainly sin, incapable of dealing with sin at all. Animal sacrifice for sin reflects mere misguided human thinking. People got it wrong. Or, as with F.F. Briggs, some combination of those. They're not mutually exclusive. People combine those in various different ways. We're going to preach Leviticus and do that well. Book that says a whole lot about animal sacrifice and all different kinds of sacrifice and what they achieve, we're going to have to grapple in some ways with Hebrews 10:4 and passages like it. And so remember some of the questions from this morning, some of the things we talked about, the potential for the Old Testament to help us reorientate or redefine how we think about some of these things. And so maybe put Hebrews 10:4 on the page, it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. Against an Old Testament backdrop, which includes Leviticus, but not only Leviticus, maybe the question becomes, in what sense is Hebrews 10:4 biblical? The Old Testament scripture is biblical. So in what sense is Hebrews 10:4 biblical? That kind of sharpens the question, doesn't it? It actually pushes us to think about, okay, how is this going to work? And they're the kind of questions that I want us to explore. So the first thing we're going to do, and you'll see I've entitled this session The Cult, the Bad, and the Holy. I want us to think about each of those different categories. So it's going to require you doing some work. How many rows do we have here? Five rows and some people in the back. That'll do. Okay, so again, if you have a handout, that'll be useful. I think there were some copies at the back or it's available. Paul sent it around. For the first two rows, I want you to think a bit about the cult. So here's some questions for you. What are the main kinds of sacrifice? Who participates? In what sort of ways? What are the purposes and outcomes of those sacrifices? Again, I'm just going to give you like 10 minutes maybe, so you don't have time to read through all of that. You might be just skimming, making observations, but hopefully together we can answer some of that. So the first two rows, if you want to look at that, and you can break into groups of three or four would be useful, I think, to just talk about those things. If you're in rows two and three, you can look at the bad. So what is the bad that Leviticus is addressing? Yeah, rows three and four. So one and two, the cult, rows three and four, the bad. What is the bad? How can the bad be addressed? And in what ways? So there's a bunch of passages to kind of skim through there. You might want to divide those up between you. And then fifth row, guy standing at the back, if you want to think about the holy. So what do these passages say about the holy? What is holy? What is holiness in Leviticus? And what are the implications of holiness for people? Okay, so I know time is short. It's like prep for your sermons that you've all been giving this week. Time is short. We know that. But what can we deduce from kind of skimming through those together from your own prior knowledge of those things, your own wrestling with these books? And we'll try and help one another sort out what does Leviticus say about the cult, the bad, and the holy. Off you go. So just split into groups of three or four, wherever you're sitting, wherever works, and have a chat about those things. You can blame Paul.
Get on that.
But there's a lot of wisdom here in the room, so let's put our collective heads together and see what we can nod out in relation to the cult, the bad, and the holy. Which might be a good title. I borrowed it from somebody else, didn't pop it up. But first of all, the cult. There's obviously lots of stuff here, more that we can say. But what's important here? What are the kind of main kinds of sacrifice? How do they work? What are they trying to do? What are they not trying to do? Let's throw out some things that you noticed in the first two rows.
grain and fellowship offering were all acts of worship, commitment, devotion, thanks, they're all voluntary.
Yep.
It was only the sin and the guilt that was mandatory.
Yeah, great. So the first three offerings are voluntary. We saw chapter one yesterday. Chapter two and three are the same. These are voluntary things you can do when you want to do them. Be spontaneous. Chapter four and five, though, the sin and the guilt offering are demanded.
Yep.
When you sin, you must do this. The language changes. Great. What else did you notice?
With the grain offering, there's an aspect of providing for the Aaron and the priests as well. They take some of it and receive some of it.
Yeah, so in terms of who gets what, with chapter one, nobody gets anything. But other chapters, different people get different portions.
Hmm.
So often it's the priests, particularly Aaron and his sons. But chapter three, it's ordinary people who brought their animal. God gets a portion, the priests get a portion, and then the people eat together. Like we said earlier this morning, it's not actually fixing anything, but seems to be a celebration of things already fixed. Now a very concrete demonstration of a shared meal, which includes God, the priests, and the worshipper. And seeing as all the meat needs to be eaten that day, it actually has to include the worshipper's family and maybe their entire village. You bring a bull. A bull is usually enough meat to feed about 1,000 people for one meal. That's a whole village coming to eat this animal on that day. It's a communal celebration is what's going on there. It's not always trying to fix something. But celebrating together is kind of part of this dynamic. Brilliant. What else?
Certainly, chapter 8, in terms of the cleansing for the ordination of Aaron and so forth, the sacrifices that make him clean and acceptable.
Yeah.
And particularly his own sins. The sacrifices.
Yes, the sacrifices are part of that dynamic of ordaining the priests. So again, not just fixing things, but ordaining and setting things up. And there the language of atonement is really strikingly applied, as you'd expect to people, but also maybe as you wouldn't expect to the altar. The altar needs atonement. So again, back to our definitional stretching. Your definition of atonement, whatever it is, has to include objects that don't sin. You can go away and think about that later tonight. As you lie and stare at the ceiling. Okay, that's really good. So there's a you'll be awake all week. Okay, so there's lots more to be said, but that's good. So there's a variation here. There are lots of different sacrifices doing lots of different things, can be used in lots of different ways. Some of them were dealing with the bad, but not necessarily dealing with the bad. Could be celebrating the good, actually. And note to kind of the involvement of the worshipper. Sacrifice is not mechanical. It's deeply, deeply relational. You must bring your animal and put your hand on the head of the animal that then you slaughter before Yahweh at the entrance. That's relational. Not just mechanical. And it's a really crucial element of all that. Brilliant. Very good. Okay, but some sacrifices are dealing with the bad. So what is the bad, rows 3 and 4? What does Leviticus describe as being the bad obstacles? Detriments or barriers between God and people. How does it describe those? How can they be addressed?
I'm interested in the intentional and unintentional sin.
Yeah.
So that was the last piece of the numbers that was brought up.
Yeah.
And so for unintentional sin, there was a process that involved blood. For intentional sin, there was nothing.
Yeah.
They were to remain guilty.
Yeah.
According to the numbers.
Yeah, fantastic. So sometimes you hear kind of the Christian cliche, kind of all sins are equal or all sins are the same. Not according to numbers, they're not.
But like manslaughter and murder, I think would be our
yeah, maybe.
A little bit, you know what I mean?
Yeah. And Numbers 35 will carefully distinguish between those two things. So that's interesting, isn't it? And when it comes to sin, not all sin is the same. There's unintentional sin. And Leviticus will kind of complicate that, Leviticus 5, maybe. There's kind of intentional sin that's of a minor level, which seems to be between people. There's a different category, but then Numbers, like here, rightly saying, has another category of kind of defiant sin. Literally in Hebrew, it's high-handed sin, or sin of a high hand. Deliberate sin, egregious sins against God. So stuff like idolatry and apostasy and that sort of thing. For which there is no sacrificial remedy. For the other two categories of sin, yes, Leviticus is saying you can do this or you can come here and do that. But for sins in that category, there is no provision.
What's the category with no provision?
High-handed sins, deliberate acts of rebellion against God. There is no sacrificial remedy for that. Which you think, oh, that makes sense of Psalm 51, doesn't it?
So isn't it? We're 15.
Numbers 15. So it's in the next there. So it makes sense of Psalm 51, doesn't it? Why does David say, I won't bring an offering? What's the context of Psalm 51? Bathsheba, which means the two sins primarily in view are murder and adultery or sexual violence, maybe, depending on how you read what's going on in Samuel. And you think, for those high-handed sins, there is no sacrificial remedy. It's not really surprising David says he's not going to bring an offering, because there is no offering. All you've left at that point is an appeal to Yahweh for forgiveness.
Does that color what Jesus says about blaspheming its Holy Spirit and, because we often trip over that.
Yeah. Both testaments don't have any problem in writing sin. We do. I wasn't sinned. Yeah, great. Brilliant insight. What else can we say about the bath?
Some really interesting things about my cleanness that comes from the Holy Spirit. But this way, one says, it is for that separate thing to get my sin, so I won't die. You know, cleanness will defile my dwelling place. Is my name? But God's dwelling place can be defiled by my cleanness.
Yeah. So you think, oh, that raises the stakes, doesn't it? For the bad. So the bad will be sin, yes, but the bad will be impurity too. Impurity can defile God's dwelling place, can defile God's residence, and that's a problem. That's a real problem. In fact, the verse you're pointing us to says actually death might be the result of doing that. That's not good. Other thoughts on the bad? Both in terms of what it is and how it can be remedied?
In chapter 5, we look at refusing to do what was right or...
So kind of knowing what you needed to do but not doing it. Or even the language. I think the language is probably best translated as forgetfulness. So you kind of do something, don't really care about it, eventually forget it, and it's brought back to your memory somehow. So yes, so that sort of dynamic. Which then there is something you can do to resolve it. And so it's interesting, isn't it? So you have the cult with all its complexity. Part of that is to deal with the bad. Not everything, but part of it is to deal with the bad. And yet the cult has inbuilt limitations. There are some things it cannot deal with. It's not comprehensive. It doesn't cover everything. It covers some things, but not everything. Which is why warnings against high-handed sin are so stark. Because for those who do them, what can you do? So don't do them. And I'm really intriguing, you know, we've talked about this before, maybe it's in our group, it's all kind of merging together at this point. But there are some acts, like in Leviticus 18, like sexual immorality, that defile not just the people who do it, but defile the temple and defile the very land. You think, back to what we were saying about 15 and 2nd, defiling the place where God lives. And you get this tension that exists through the Old Testament because you have people who keep on sinning and defiling the land. And yet God ultimately wants a place to dwell in and a people to dwell with. How can that tension ever be resolved? The people keep defiling the land. And it's interesting and maybe sobering, as you read through the Old Testament and all the places where there's a clash between those two things, where kind of there's a choice presented to God, you can either have a people to dwell with or a land to dwell in. You don't seem to be able to have both. That Yahweh consistently chooses the land. The people are exiled. The people are executed. The people are wiped out with a flood. Yahweh will have a place. The people are dispensable. That's interesting to kind of ponder, put in your theological pipe and smoke for a bit, isn't it? great. So there's the cult with all this complexity, deals with the bad, but some of that can't be dealt with, kind of leaves questions hanging. At the end of Leviticus and Numbers. What about the holy, though? What can we say about the holy? So, guys in the back, what is holy or holiness in the book of Leviticus? God. What are the implications? If God is holy, yeah. Sounds so straightforward and yet so important. God is holy. And you could probably put the word alone in that sentence. God alone is holy, intrinsically holy. It's a very descriptor of godness, if we can use that language. So I think Isaiah 6, holy, holy, holy is Yahweh Almighty. This is the descriptor of who God is. He alone is holy, intrinsically. What else can we say about holiness, though? Yeah. Yeah, so here's more kind of stretching of our categories. Holiness is not just a moral category, because things and places can also be holy and made holy. Time can be made holy. You have holy days and holy feasts and holy months. So holiness, whatever definition we have, has to be able to encompass all of those things. Yeah, that's great. So holiness is given to people, places, objects, presumably to make them fit to exist and to be safe in God's holy presence. Because as we saw with the bad, whatever that is, sin, impurity, or both, threatens the survival of those who encounter holiness. So lots of illustrations you could use, but think of a nuclear reactor. If God is intrinsically holy, imagine God as being the nuclear reactor. Do you want to go in there? Probably not. And if you were sent in there, you'd say, give me a list of instructions. How can I possibly be safe as I go in there? And you think, that's what Leviticus is doing, isn't it? Mm-hmm. Here's a list of instructions that you're going to need to survive God's holy presence. Because holiness is not just who God is and what he is, but is dangerous. And so impurity and sin or whatever the bad is endangers people. And yet, Leviticus points to dealing with that, doesn't it? In chapters 1 to 9, we saw it yesterday, the sketch on the board, priests and sacrifice working together. Get to the end of chapter 9, Moses and Aaron enter into the holy space of the tabernacle and survive. What is Leviticus saying at that point? It's saying ritual, the ritual that Yahweh has given, is effective. Effective enough to stake your life on and go into that place and come out alive. So that's good. All of those things are really helpful. So God alone is holy, proximity to the holy endangers the bad. There's a whole range of bad things that impact the individual and the community. And the cult is God's gracious means of dealing with the bad. And it's given by Yahweh directly. And so some of you might like red letter Bibles. I'm not going to tell you what I think. some of you might like them, but you think, 87% of Leviticus is direct speech from God. So if we had Trinitarian red letter Bibles, 87% of Leviticus would be red. These are words spoken directly by God to his people to enable them to come into his presence, prescribing rituals and rites that change reality, and yet that's limited. There are some things that does not cover, like high-handed sins. Great, so that's some Old Testament work that we've done. Let's do some New Testament work. Because I think grappling with those, and yes, there's more to be done, gives us new eyes to read Hebrews 10:4. New options on the table. And so I think Leviticus numbers raise a number of possible limitations to what Hebrews 10:4 is actually meaning. And so again, I put these in your notes. Let me talk to those briefly, and then you can do some thinking on it. So Hebrews 10:4 could be just a corrective regarding process. So it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats by itself to take away sins. Because blood is just one component of a really kind of complicated act. There's lots of other things you need to do. You need to bring the animal, put your hand on it, slaughter it, cut it up. There's lots of things going on. It's not just the blood. So is that what Hebrews 10:4 is doing, correcting the process? It's an option. Hebrews 10:4 could be asserting agency over means. So it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins, because Yahweh is the one who takes away sins. We know it's God who takes away the sins. The blood isn't magical. Blood doesn't do it. Yahweh's told you to use it, but it's not the blood itself. It's God who takes away sins. So is Hebrews 10:4 really just saying, read Leviticus properly? Maybe. Regarding the scope of sins, Hebrews 10:4 could be reaffirming what Leviticus says, that it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away high-handed sins. Which sins is Hebrews 10:4 talking about? Is it all sins? Is it not all the same? or it's just high-handed sins, the ones that the Levitical cult is unable to take away. Is that what's been taken away here? Before, well, that phrase, blood of bulls and goats, sometimes taken like Bruce does with kind of, here's just sacrifice in general, it particularly evokes the Day of Atonement. That's the day where the blood of bulls and goats gets used. And obviously Hebrews 9 and 10 revolves around the Day of Atonement. I'll get you to look at that in a second. And so is Hebrews 10, 4, is that just saying that it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats on the Day of Atonement to take away sins? Because remember, the Day of Atonement is not about forgiveness. Forgiveness isn't mentioned in Leviticus 16. It's all about purification. That's a possibility too. Day of Atonement purified the earthly sanctuary. So again, picking up on some of those aspects of both the holy and the bad, these things, holiness and or impurity affect not just people, but objects. And so the Day of Atonement purified not just the people, but the earthly sanctuary. But it didn't make any claim to purify the heavenly sanctuary, of which the earthly one is just a copy, that Moses is told to copy exactly back in Exodus. And so is Hebrews 10:4 saying that? It's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins from the heavenly tabernacle. Or maybe lastly, Hebrews 10:4, is that limiting, or is it kind of talking about the limits of what Leviticus is talking about? In other words, you can deal with the effects, but not with the sources, like we saw this morning. Is that what Hebrews 10:4 is saying? That it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away the source of sins. Different options. All that fit better with Leviticus and Numbers, and yet how do each of those options work with Hebrews? So we've done some Old Testament work that's given us some new options maybe we didn't have before, but now we've got to see, well, which of those, if any, fits within the worldview of Hebrews. It'd be nice if some of them do, because that might be a nice happy correlation. And I'll suggest to you that they do. But I want you to talk about that. Again, you can screen to the groups you're in before is the easiest. And look at Hebrews 9 and 10. Again, I'm assuming you're familiar with this. Lots of you will have preached this before. Some of you think are doing it currently, actually. But what do you notice in Hebrews 9 and 10? Especially in connection to Leviticus. What is Christ's role? What does he accomplish? And here's the real question. What is Hebrews 10:4 claiming canonically? So instead of ditching Leviticus and pretending it doesn't say anything, hearing Leviticus carefully like you've just been doing, how does that help us read Hebrews 10:4 well? That's the real question. So again, another few minutes in your groups just to talk about that, and then we'll hear what you come up with. Off you go. I should say that those options are not mutually exclusive. You don't just have to pick one. You could actually pick all if you want. Right. Talking about, interesting to hear some of the comments that have filtered up to the front. Questions and things we've been throwing out. Hebrews 10, 9 and 10 explicitly recalls Leviticus, particularly the Day of Atonement. That's the running analogy all the way through Hebrews 9 and 10. So the author is wanting us to grapple with Leviticus and apply our knowledge of Leviticus to what he's saying in order to understand Jesus. So I think that big picture is straightforward. It's there right on the surface of the text. The question is, what is the author doing with that? And particularly that statement in 10:4, how do we read that canonically against the background that the author is explicitly pointing us to? So let's have a go. What's going to be important to consider in putting all the pieces together? Yeah.
I think the author of Hebrews is drawing a contrast between the temporary nature of the sacrifices in Leviticus with the one overall nature of Christ's sacrifice. And so that would lead us towards number 16, that he's looking at the source of sin and sin as a condition, not just as an act.
Yeah. Yeah, great. And so that language of hapax that keeps on appearing, kind of the once for all language. There's a real strong contrast between something that's repeated, something that's once for all. So in, you're pushing us to maybe think of option number 6, that this is dealing not just with kind of sin and we deal with that, but actually something much deeper, kind of the very source of sin itself.
Yeah.
And that's kind of the language of once for all, dealing with sin at its very source, kind of turning off the tap, as it were.
Mm. and impossible to make perfect.
Yep.
But that sounds more global than just one off.
Yeah. Yeah, so the language of perfection that permeates the epistle as well. Yeah. Great, that's really helpful. So one thing to put on the table. What other things do you want to put on the table?
Is there something in obviously talking about the earthly holding plants, looking back at the Leviticus and what we set up again, you're also looking at when Christ appears as a high priest of the good things that have come, even though it's greater and more perfect thing. You know, that he appears and we're not made with hands that is not of this creation.
Mm-hmm.
Is it now taking us outside the physical creation of the world?
Yeah. Yeah, so verse 23 is that we're looking at line 23. Yeah, if it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified, so think Day of Atonement, purifying the people, but also purifying the tent and the altar. If that was necessary to do, the author says, well, how much more is it necessary to cleanse the heavenly things with better sacrifices? That's interesting, isn't it? The whole conception of a heavenly tabernacle that also needs to be cleansed. And the author saying, "Oh, Jesus does that. That's interesting, isn't it? Like, what is that? How does that work?" And again, back to what Moses said. So the language of tablet or pattern or model that's used in Exodus is really intriguing. So Moses is told to be very careful how he builds the tabernacle, to do it exactly according to the model or the pattern that he's been given, which is presumably the heavenly tabernacle. That's the logic.
Yeah.
Something existing in God's realm that Moses builds a copy of, that needs to be cleansed. Now the author of Hebrews saying, well, the heavenly one also needs to be cleansed. And that Jesus and what Jesus has done also does that. Day of Atonement can never do that. It's only dealing in the earthly sphere. But Jesus can deal with the heavenly sphere. Yeah, and in his action as high priest. And so that's really fundamental. Here, Jesus isn't just a priest. Jesus is a high priest who on the Day of Atonement could go into the earthly sanctuary, into the Holy of Holies. The logic here is that Jesus goes into the heavenly Holy of Holies to secure purification. Well, that's interesting. What else do we want to put on the table?
I'm not saying it seems to say that the sacrifice did have an effect.
Sorry, say that again?
Verse 13, no, chapter 9, 13, sorry. Seems to say that the blood of Christ and Lord did purify in some way.
Yeah. Yeah. That's really interesting again, isn't it? So the author of Hebrews is saying, oh, Leviticus cult achieved real things. Real cleansing. So it kind of rules out the whole symbolic idea. You know, it's not what the author of Hebrews is saying. It's not symbolic. It's actually doing something real in the real world. And yet I think I heard Will say this part in relation to that, that the language of how much more begins to come in. You think, oh, so the cult could do this. How much more then does Jesus do this?
Mm.
It's not a contrast between unreal and real, but between minor and major, maybe, or partial and complete, whatever language you want to use. Frequent and repeated, once for all. Like different language you can use there. So it's not something entirely different that's going on, but bringing something that's already there in part to its full and final completion. Yeah, excellent.
I think 10 verse 1 is like a similar kind of thing, of a shadow reality. I guess in that sense, there's still shadow's still real, but it's not as real in the sense of...
Yeah, shadow and reality. And shadow's not necessarily a negative thing. I think sometimes we assume it's a negative thing, and it's kind of pejorative, but that's not necessarily so. And why would the author of Hebrews, who kind of taps into tabernacle and Leviticus and sacrifice so much, then be pejorative about it? That doesn't make any sense. But I think it's certainly that language of something that was there in part, and I seen more fully, or more realized more fully.
10:3 is interesting. Speaking of sacrifices as a reminder of sins.
Do you want to tell us what you think that means, Andrew?
Well, I think partly that's what it seems to be within the continued nature of them. So the every year.
Yeah.
It seems like a yearly sacrifice, a yearly reminder in that sense.
Yeah.
It's part of what Andy was saying before, the repetition.
Yeah, so it's going to fall into that contrast between kind of the repeated again and again and the once for all, the hapax.
Mm.
And so it's falling into that. And And yet, interesting to ask the question is in relation to 10.3, what exactly is the problem? Sometimes the assumption made that the problem is the ineffectiveness of the cult. Just couldn't do it. So you're like trying to, I don't know, it's like a broken bike or something. You just keep falling off because the bike is broken. That it's actually becomes a kind of a way of understanding the cult as being ineffective or detrimental or something. That's not what the author's saying, though, isn't it? Where does the author locate the problem? Repetition. Yeah, in the repetition. But why is the repetition needed? Is it because the cult is faulty?
No, the sins carried on.
It's the people who are faulty. So look at 8 verse 8. But God found fault with the people. God is the one who set up the cult. Why would God find fault with the cult? That doesn't make any sense. God finds a fault with the people who keep on sinning. And because the people keep on sinning, there's no end to sin. The source of sin hasn't been overcome. The tap hasn't been turned off. And so they keep needing to do these things month by month, year by year, because the problem is the people. Which pushes us back to Old Testament expectation, doesn't it? The Old Testament recognizes that this is the problem. Sometimes I think in our language, we try and wriggle out of really where the Bible points the finger. And so you see it sometimes and hear it sometimes in the language of kind of fallen world or broken creation. We tend to blame that. It's a fallen world or the creation is broken or language like that. You think that's not really what the Bible's saying. The Bible's saying people are broken. People are the problem. And Hebrews is doing that. God found fault with the people. And it's really interesting that this whole block of kind of 9 and 10 is bracketed on both sides by quoting Jeremiah. And as you can see at the end of chapter 8 and again in chapter 10, this long quotation of Jeremiah 31, which talks about the day climatically that God will forgive his people their wickedness and remember their sins no more. And in the context of Old Testament hope and expectation, that day is not just a day of kind of securing forgiveness. It is that, but it's more than that. It's the day where God will so transform his people that they will no longer sin, no longer be guilty, and therefore no longer need means to overcome guilt, because they'll stop sinning. That's what the Old Testament prophets are looking forward to, isn't it? Like it's Jeremiah here, it's Ezekiel, I think Ezekiel 36. What is Ezekiel looking forward to? The day where God will take hearts of stone and make them into hearts of flesh, where he'll put his spirit within people and move them to obedience. Ending sin, overcoming the source of sin, as well as the cleansing that removes all defilement. That's what the prophets are looking forward to. The author points us to Jeremiah as the kind of the exemplar of that, and then points us to Jesus and said, in Jesus, God has fully and finally completed his act of overcoming sin. Not just dealing with its effects, it is that. And again, not just dealing with the effects on people, it is that. But as you were saying, dealing with the effects of the heavenly tabernacle is so much bigger than that. But it's also turning off the tap. Transformation of God's people. Filling them with the Spirit. Moving them to obedience. Because this is what is required for God's people to be able to fully and finally dwell with God and never be removed again is an utter transformation of the human heart and mind. And Hebrews is saying, it's Jesus. All glory to him. But it's Jesus and the picture of Jesus that becomes so much more clear when we follow the lead of the author of Hebrews himself or herself, whoever it is, and say, Leviticus is pointing us in this direction. It helps us. They're saying go back and know it. He's assuming people know it, I think. But it just makes so much more sense. Again, it's just a much clearer picture of Jesus and the extent of all that he's come to accomplish. I'm sorry.